Pride of Wrestling Network World Heavyweight Champion. And make sure you tune into the Alliance Blog every week. You heard it here first. Straight from Bobby.
Can you believe that there are some people in this world that did not tune in to the Alliance Blog podcast? Shame on you!
Shame on you! My name is Ella Indy, and I'm one half of the NWA Women's World Tag Team Champion.
And I'm Kenzie Page, the other half of the NWA World Women's Tag Team Champion.
And you better go listen to the Alliance Blog, what's it called, the podcast,
period.
Or you're ugly. Period. Your power approved.
Are you ready?
Power.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm building an alliance.
God bless the internet.
Okay, let's party.
It's showtime.
It's time for the Alliance Guys podcast with your hosts Kevin Frazier, Jaden, DKM, and J Cal.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to the special edition of the Alliance Guys podcast, a presentation of alliance-wrestling.com, your number one source for news and information for the National Wrestling Alliance and the United Wrestling Network. I'm J Cal, and tonight we have a special interview with a good friend of mine. And a special project that he's working on that I think you guys will be really interested in checking out. It's called Blood and Paint. But let me introduce you to my friend, Brandon Knoll of Destiny's Comics. Brandon, what's up, my friend? How are you?
Oh, yeah, dig it.
Creed rises to the top. Sorry.
Top, tippy top. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, man. Glad to have you here. We've been talking about doing this for a while now, so I'm glad that you're able to join us here on the Alliance Guys podcast and just talk a little bit about, it's kind of interesting. It turns out we have a mutual friend, which was really weird because I started seeing your stuff online before I knew you were friends with Eduardo. So it's kind of cool that we have this connection out here in the Hemacito area, if you will. But What drew me to what you were doing, and of course, we'll get into all of it, but you were posting these great, these paintings of WCW art with the hashtag WCW on Wednesdays, of course, which threw a monkey wrench in all of the plans of people who were trying to profess their love for internet models and fiancés, and I thought that was awesome and hilarious, but some of your artwork connected with me because, like you, I grew up a fan of WCW, and so I don't want to steal too much more of your thunder, but let's get right into it. What was the plan when you started your Instagram account and these hashtag WCWs? What was going on in your head, and let's talk about that first.
About 4 years ago, I saw I'm not an internet savvy guy. Internet culture moves way too fast. And I get left behind a lot of the times, and that's okay. But I saw WCW was trending on like Twitter then, now X. And I thought, oh, new documentary, new tell-all book. Like why is WCW trending? And I came to learn that the next generation, Gen Z or whatever, WCW to them means Women Crush Wednesday. And so it was an excuse to post photos of lovely ladies in bikinis, and there's nothing wrong with that. But to me, WCW will always be World Championship Wrestling. Like, this was the first time that society or culture was moving on without me. Like, no, WCW doesn't mean that, and it now means this new thing. And it just boggled my mind that this was a multi-billion dollar corporation in the 90s. And that you can just, it never happened. It never existed. So as a cartoonist and painter, I started posting every Wednesday. It started off as little black and white sketches, more caricatures. And then about 6 months after that, I'm not a good caricaturist. but I'm a pretty good painter. So I end up starting putting a little bit more effort into it. And so every week for almost 4 years, I posted a painting of a WCW wrestler or something from the history of WCW with the hashtag WCW, along with about a 2 to 3 paragraph, you know, like I put a lot of work into those, the thing that you can only see on Instagram because you couldn't see it on Twitter because, you know, they don't let you write these giant things on Twitter. But I go on to write 3 paragraphs about why Bam Bam Bigelow meant something to me as a kid, or, you know, 2 paragraphs on the Disco Inferno, you know, and
did you really need 2 paragraphs on Disco Inferno?
I did. And unfortunately he only saw the Twitter version, which was cut short.
Yeah.
So he cut back on me on Twitter, but I don't think he ever saw how much I actually wrote about how much I loved him and that kind of thing. But yeah, this went on for almost 4 years, and now I am I have over I don't want to say 200 paintings, but over 150 paintings. It's a bit of a collection of a weird kind of niche subject. And so I've decided to put everything together in a 1 art book, Blood and Paint, that collects all the paintings as well as some of the writings. It's a retrospective from a fan's point of view.
What I have to self-report here, I'm not only a friend, but I'm also a customer. I did purchase some of your work before. In fact, one of my best friends graduated from Long Beach State earlier, or I guess last year. Wow, time flies. And I bought your photo of Harlem Heat right before Booker T said some regrettable things live on air. And my buddy got a kick about that. He was very excited to receive that. And when he opened it up, because I got a really nice frame for it too, right? And he just opened it up thinking like, well, what is this? What is Jay getting me? And here it is, you know, Booker T, we're coming for you, Hogan. I'm not going to say the rest of it.
Yeah. The infamous N-word drop.
Yes. And it was much appreciated. So I could attest to the detail that you put into the artwork. And obviously you're painting that by hand, and then you're taking a digital copy with your, I'm assuming your phone or your camera. And
I have a giant flatbed scanner.
Oh, okay. So you're scanning them directly.
I scanned it's not just a photo. It's a high res scan of every painting.
Oh, wow. And then you also did for us the Viamos Lucha Libre channel, the banner for that as well. And I was really jazzed with that. That one came out looking really good, and I really appreciated that one.
That was one of my favorite paintings I ever did. Like, I mean, I get more compliments on that than most anything, because I don't know if Lucha Libre gets as much love as it, you know, should. And I was painting some of the legends, and that was actually a really fun piece to do.
Well, and what I liked about it is you were so diverse with the roster. Like, there's La Parca, there's Santo, and then there, right there in the middle. Why did I forget their name right now? Oh, geez.
Well, El Santo's in the middle.
Oh, yes. Gosh, it's killing me now. Now I got to look it up. Hang on just a second. I'm real professional, Jay. There was the Exotico that you put in there, and I cannot think of that person's name at the moment. But that person, I actually got to see wrestle quite a few times live through Championship Wrestling from Hollywood when they were an NWA affiliate. In fact, it's on the tip of my tongue, and I just can't think of their name right now. Jeez.
He had the Prime movie made about him.
Yeah.
If I could, I don't know if you're allowed to show images or what, because I can share the.
Yeah.
So. Wrong folder.
If I beat you to it, then I'll pull it up on my end.
I don't know how to share on this thing.
If you could send it to me in a private message, I could pull it up.
Yeah, I can easily do that.
Well, I never said I was professional here, just so you know.
Hey, you know, we're all flying by the seat of our pants, man.
Oh, man, I feel like a bum right now.
No, I just sent it to you in the Instagram chat.
I see it. Nope, it's not there. Not yet, anyways. So anyways, let's as I'm trying to pull that up, you know, I always tell people I love WCW. Now I was a WWF kid growing up because, you know, we live here on the West Coast. The WWF was out here much more frequently than they were on the East Coast. There it is. Now it just came up. What drew me a lot to WCW was the menagerie of talent. There was so many different individuals available in, or not available, but so many different talents that worked in WCW. You would see talents from New Japan. You'd see talents from Mexico. What was it about WCW that was so enticing to you? What made it so such that you wanted to embark on this journey?
Well, when I was real little, because I mean, you know, I grew up. There it is. Yeah, I grew up mostly as a '90s kid, but you know, a little bit of the '80s, rock and roll, Hulk Hogan, all that kind of stuff. But to me, pro wrestling was Hulk Hogan, right? So Hulk Hogan goes to WCW. That's where pro wrestling is. I wasn't young enough to really distinguish different federations or even Lucha Libre and at that point in my life. So I mean, we're talking you know, was it Legion of Doom era WCW?
Yeah.
Early, you know, 93, 92.
So we're talking like Sting, Vader, Ron Simmons, the Nasty Boys.
Yes.
Mankind, Steve Austin, stunning Steve Austin.
Stunning Steve Austin with the long blonde hair and the, you know, him and Brian Pillman. And, you know, so I was watching it from back then. And then, you know, I became a Shawn Michaels fan and started following WWF. But when, you know, but me and my friends, we were always talking about Hulk Hogan. It was always, everything went back to Hulk Hogan, Macho Man. You know, my grandfather was a big Ric Flair fan. So
your grandfather had great tastes.
He did. The first pay-per-view I think I ever saw was Bash of the Beach 93.
Okay.
And Ric Flair comes out with like six girls on each side. I was as a little kid thinking, yes, I want to do that. That is who I want to be. That's who, you know. So just as a fan, I fell in love with WCW. And I know this was not during the Monday Night Wars. This was not the common thing. Most people watched Raw and recorded Nitro. I watched Nitro and recorded Raw. Like I was that kid who was all in on, I mean, when you know, Hogan does the leg drop and betrays all that is right and good in the world and becomes evil, I cried. I was a little kid. I broke my heart, you know?
Yeah, no. I'm a little bit older than you, so like my memories of Hogan, obviously, like I can remember sitting there watching WrestleMania 2 when he beat King Kong Bundy, right? Mm. And going back later and watching WrestleMania 1 with Mr. T and Superfly Snuka. So all those memories go with me. But like, you know, kind of like the highlight, I was in sixth grade. Everyone in my family was rooting for Hulk Hogan. all my friends were rooting for Hulk Hogan. And I was like, no, it's all about this Ultimate Warrior guy. He's the Intercontinental Champion. He's going to win both those belts. So, like, that's my kind of lasting image is Warrior holding both the titles over Hogan. And then Hogan would come back and he would end Yokozuna's brief run initially and then before making that jump to WCW. And it was a big deal at the time because, up until that point, Ric Flair was a huge name in the 80s when it came to wrestling. But Hulk Hogan was a sports entertainer and was literally like, you could see him in the movies. You could see him on late night with Jay Leno or hosting. I don't think he hosted Saturday Night Live, but I think he was on episodes of SNL. And it just he's in
Gremlins too.
Yeah, he broke the fourth wall. It was like Deadpool. And it's like with a guy like Hogan, it was the first time that WCW signed somebody that was of grand significance. And I'm not trying to discount anybody else who, went back between WCW and the WWF, but Hogan was the game changer and really set WCW up for its history going forward. So when he made that jump to WCW, like you said, that got you to watch it. But then later when he joined the NWO and stabbed the WCW fan base in the heart, I could get why that would make you burst into tears.
I know he's kind of regarded as somewhat of a controversial figure, but Eric Bischoff.
Yeah.
Okay. And the numbers don't lie. When Eric Bischoff took over WCW, WCW was a company that lost $10 million every year. That's what they did. That's what they did. This is before the Hogan signing. After Hogan, after Nash and Hall, it became a company that was making $36 million a year.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, yes, his people skills were probably not what it should have been as a manager. He was also very young.
Yeah.
In that position. I mean, there's the story of him throwing coffee at Eddie Guerrero. He was under immense pressure. And it's sad to hear some of the backstage stuff. But at the same time, if you just look at what he did on paper, he took something that was failing and made it incredibly successful.
Well, as I was writing up the press release for the show today, it's one of those things where, like, you got to think about it. Before there was WCW, a lot of people, again, attribute Jim Crockett Promotions, which became WCW, as the NWA. So there was that natural migration for NWA fans to go directly to WCW because at that point, Jim Crockett was such a big NWA member that when they became WCW, people just thought the whole thing, the NWA was WCW, right?
And they had served.
Yeah, and I mean, AWA was at that point was already gone. We hadn't seen the revolution of ECW yet. And New Japan was still in Japan and, wrestling in Mexico was still in Mexico. So it's like, that was the first time that you had two perennial powerhouses of wrestling companies. Now, WWE has never taken a step back and back when, Vince was running it and kind of took over all the territories. He made sure that his business was leveraged for success. Jim Crockett tried to keep up with Vince, but never could, never had that same kind of cash. You had Ted Turner come in and basically you had an open check to sign whoever they could to get the right people involved. The problem with WCW, though, is that, Vince McMahon, although not ever traditionally trained as a pro wrestler per se, grew up in the industry where Eric Bischoff did not have that same luxury, was not from wrestling. He got into wrestling, but he wasn't from wrestling.
Even before Eric Bischoff, it was mismanaged because Ted, I forget the gentleman's name, but there was an executive who was in charge of Papa John's. And then he was put in charge of WCW because he had made Papa John's successful. So they put pizza executives in charge of WCW. They put different, it was a revolving door. And there's a great book called Nitro that goes into the history of all this. And, Jim Cornette talked about the Papa John's guy, and his big contribution to pro wrestling was the Ding Dongs.
Oh, wow.
Like, are you familiar with the Ding Dongs?
Yeah, that goes back to the Jim, yeah, the Jim Crockett promotion.
Jim Crockett, yeah, just, you know, was W, because he was that era with WCW. The Ding Dongs was the one thing when, because over 4 years, I started reading the book, reading history books. I've seen all the WWE documentaries a dozen times. But the Ding Dongs was the one piece of history that I kind of fell in love with because of how stupid it is. And I've painted the Ding Dongs a couple of times over the years because of just how insane that was. Let me see if I can't, you know, like.
Amazing.
Yeah. You know, it's wrestling at its most stupid. From Belleville, Mississippi, or wherever they were from, you know, and they would ring the bells. But it was stuff like that, you know, going back through the history of WCW made me fall in love with it even more as a fan today.
So, you know, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No. So you had said earlier when we just started about Bam Bam Bigelow and what his significance to WCW was that your guy? Was Bam Bam your dude? Or who, like, besides Hogan, who else were you rooting for? Who else were you checking out? What was your
a big Vader fan? I was a big Vader fan.
My guy.
Because you know, I was always a heavier kid. Those are big guys. And to see Vader hit a moonsault, to see Vader do some of the stuff that he did. I know people will say he was a little rough or whatever, but that was, he came that Japanese hard style. Other than Mick Foley, I can't think of anybody who he actually ever hurt in the ring. You know,
well, that wasn't even his fault. It was
like the ropes. Yeah. So like, you know, I absolutely love Vader. He was also on Boy Meets World.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yep.
As the bully's father. You know, so it was, again, so when you're younger and you see some of these characters, you mentioned King Kong Bundy. He was on a Married with Children a couple of times.
His wrestler was the inspiration for the family's name. The guys that created Married with Children were big wrestling fans, and that's why they had Bundy as the last name, which I don't know if a lot of people know that.
And also the neighbors were named Rhodes after Dusty Rhodes.
Yep.
You know, the 90s television, man, it's all just, that's what I grew up on.
Getting back to Vader, so I'm a huge Vader guy too. And, you know, part of the reason why I liked Vader is because he was born in Linwood, California. You know, I was born in Linwood, California. He played football for the Rams for a brief time. But besides that, at one point in his career, he held the world title equivalent belt in Japan and in Mexico and the United States. Later, he would hold the world title equivalent in Japan, Germany, and in the U.S. So, like, he was not only the world champion, but, like, he was the world's champion. He held multiple world titles at one point, you know, holding the UWA title for Mexico, holding the IWGP Heavyweight Championship in New Japan, and holding the Catch Wrestling Alliance title in Germany. Also, you know, later holding the WCW World Championship. So that dude to me is like tops. Of course, he had his shoot fighting career too. I mean, his battles with Stan Hansen, where Stan Hansen literally knocked his eye out during a match and Vader popped it back in. I mean, that dude was as tough as nails. And he's a guy that I always wish that WWF would have done something more with, because he's such a great wrestler, such an anomaly, like you said, doing moonsaults and backflips in the ring, stuff that most guys that size could not do, and he did it with the greatest of ease.
I mean, yeah, the Mammoth. I mean, that, even when they finally inducted him in the Hall of Fame and they used the name the Mammoth, I was like, oh, really? It's just a way. That's a waste. I mean, that the weird, creepy when he was in Japan, that helmet thing.
Oh yeah.
You know, the smoke and the. I actually just sent you in the chat a couple of Vader paintings I did.
We're gonna we'll get those up too. Yeah, that's Vader, man. I'm telling you, he's a pretty good dude. You sent those in Instagram?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you said Vader, and who else? Who else was your guy in WCW, or was that it?
Well, no, I mean.
Mick Foley.
He was one of those guys who, like, I fell in love with more during the Mankind era.
Sure.
You know, but going back and watching his Cactus Jack stuff, again, one of the things I absolutely, some of the paintings I did were just for me. Right. Like, here's my, I did a Cactus Jack versus Arachnoman.
That's amazing. Arachnoman.
You know,
did you watch Into the Spider-Verse, just to go off subject here a little bit?
Yeah. I'm more of a comic book guy than anything.
I know that about you, but I swear when all those Spider-Man were together that I saw Arachnoman, and I haven't gone back and watched the movie since, but I was in the theater to go, purple, yellow, that's the Arachnoman. That dude's in Bad Street. Let's go.
The purple and yellow Spider-Man, this is so nerdy. Was not Arachnoman. It was Bullet Point Spider-Man from a mini series where that Spider-Man is actually Bruce Banner.
What?
They did a series years ago called Bullet Points, and it's a 5-issue mini series where the guy who created Captain America's serum.
Yeah,
he is shot 24 hours earlier. So Captain America is never created, and it's a Marvel universe without Captain America. And it's all about the ripple effects. My Vader versus Sting.
And then, of course, Vader versus Cactus Jack.
Yeah.
Really cool.
And in that universe, they do the gamma experiment, and Bruce Banner, while looking over the Arizona field, is bitten by a radioactive spider from his gamma experiment, and it really messes him up. He's much more of a spider, a man spider creature under there than, you know. But the purple and yellow is the Bullet Point Spider-Man.
Okay. Well, in my mind, it was
Arachnoman.
I was like, "Yeah, let's go." Mm. Well, that's unfortunate, but thanks for the information there. Because I saw it, I'm like, I've never seen. I used to be a very avid comic book follower. I used to check out, you know, like I liked, I kind of liked some of the. I was an X-Men guy. Like I liked X-Men, X-Force, X-Factor, all that.
Now's a good time to be an X-Men fan.
Yeah, in the 90s for sure. I also jumped on to stuff that was a little bit more obscure. So like the Thor Corps and the Green Lantern Corps, I just thought those were really cool. And then like not Iron Man, but War Machine. Like I'm like, yeah, let's go, man. This is cool. So like, and then like this whole Spider-Man 2099, that came out when right in the middle of when I was collecting comics. So I jumped in on that, but I did not know of the lore of the Bruce Banner Spider-Man. So that's interesting. I didn't know that, but yeah, I was kind of like, just like I said, I thought that was Arachnoman paint homage. That's the pro wrestler.
The Bullet Points was a really fun series because it's a what if universe where it's all about the ripple effect. Because this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. You know, yeah. But 2099 is. I grew up collecting all the 2099 books. Ghost Rider 2099 was one of my favorites. And then they had the World of 2099, which came out quarterly and that was like a thicker book, and you get a couple of short stories of like different things going on in the 2099 universe. But yeah, comics wrestling was kind of my first love. And then, comics was always my second love. And then, I originally wanted to be a pro wrestler, and then I got hurt. And that dream kind of fell to the wayside.
Yeah.
And, so then I went all in on comic books and sequential art and, you know, that kind of thing.
So bringing it back to wrestling, and I do want to talk about more of your projects, more than just Blood and Paint, but getting back to wrestling, because
that's what we're here. It's a wrestling podcast.
But comics are cool too, and as anyone who's watching this knows, we tend to fall off topic quite a bit, especially when it comes to like MCU and comics. You know, that's fun stuff. And similarly, like I did fall in love with wrestling and comic books right about the same time, to be quite honest. And I felt like most of my teenage years, if I wasn't playing a sport in high school or chasing girls on the weekend, I was watching wrestling or buying comics or even, you know, watching cartoons. And there's such, you know, so many parallels between them. You know, you have the good guys and the bad guys, and especially during like WCW up until maybe the NWO, it was very clearly defined roles as who was good and who was bad. So when Hogan came in, they had the big parade, and you know, Sting was there, and then I remember there was episodes of Nitro when Lex Luger came back to WCW, and he came back as a heel, but then he would team with Sting, who was like the uber baby face, and then you would have when they wrestled together, as he'd come down the aisle with Sting, and you know, Sting was celebrated and fans were giving him high fives, and Luger would give high fives. And then as soon as Sting turns around, Luger would just stop touching the fans and just narrow his focus down to the ring. And then when Sting would turn around, he'd be back into being a babyface again. It was a lot of fun. But like, of course, that whole NWO moment really kind of ratified how wrestling was treated, and that well-defined good guy versus bad guy kind of became this very much gray area. And then we'd see that roll out into, of course, ECW. There was a lot of gray in ECW. You didn't really know who the good guys or the bad guys.
There weren't any good guys in ECW. I loved ECW. No one was good in ECW. There was no Gallahan in ECW. There was no one. The closest you get is Tommy Dreamer.
Yeah.
But Tommy Dreamer is not a Galahad-like character. Tommy Dreamer is the voice of the fan in ECW.
That's fair.
Right? Like, you want to see this, I'm going to give you this. And he represented the fans. Everybody saw themselves in ECW as Tommy Dreamer because Tommy Dreamer was the underdog. He was the guy you could root for. But there was no classically like straight hero figure in ECW.
Yeah, and like anytime there was somebody who was close, like a Tommy Dreamer or like a Mikey Whipwreck, you know, things would happen, and of course that would all change anyways. You know, they would have a guy like RVD who the fans would root for, but to be honest, he didn't wrestle like a baby face. And you had a guy who was, you know, proclaimed to be carrying the company on his back like Shane Douglas, but then, or Taz even, but then, you know, again, didn't wrestle like the traditional baby face. And I mean, they would even fall in love with guys like Terry Funk or, you know, Mick Foley, or even like a Sabu. But again, none of those guys acted or wrestled like a baby face. So a lot of gray area in ECW. And then of course in WWF, the whole attitude era.
And that bled over into WCW because a lot of you forget a lot of those guys went to Sandman was hardcore hack.
That's right.
Raven, of course, took his whole flock. Perry Saturn.
Yep.
Had an amazing run in WCW.
But even before those guys, I mean, you go back to in the mid 90s when they brought in, you know, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, Juventud Guerrera, Rey Mysterio, Chris Benoit, Too Cold. Well, the Too Cold Scorpio was actually the opposite. He left WCW to be in ECW, but they brought in all this very good talent, both from ECW and from Lucha Libre, AAA. They built their whole cruiserweight division around those guys. Chris Jericho also in that group, and then later, like you said, Lance Storm, Mike Awesome. the wheel just kept spinning, and anytime a new talent came into ECW, got over and became big, it seemed like there was a direct route to WCW.
WCW or WWE.
Yeah.
You know, which we now know Paul Heyman, had more of a working relationship with WWE. WCW, they were clearly watching ECW, and when something would work in WCW, it was, you mentioned Mikey Whipwreck. He wrestled in WCW.
Yeah.
Sabu, one of my favorite paintings I did was Sabu versus Alex Wright.
I don't remember that match at all. Why did that one stick out to you?
Because it was one of those things where somebody had reached out to me and asked me to, because I also would do direct commissions.
Yes.
Right. So there was a couple of paintings I did of like Jake the Snake, or somebody would reach it, and somebody wanted a painting of Sabu. And I thought, well, maybe I can kill two birds with one stone and do something from his time in WCW. And so there's a moment where he's wrestling Alex Wright, and he does a Hurricane Rana over the top rope, and he throws Alex Wright to the floor. But it was this painting I did that I absolutely loved, because I got to show Sabu's diaphragm completely stretched out. It almost looked like a Renaissance painting of the way I really got to actually just work on his anatomy. And it was less about, it became less about showcasing Sabu and more about, this guy's anatomy and the scars and that kind of thing.
Get to really give it some detail too.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite paintings that I ever did. I'm going to send you a link in the chat. It's a gallery of all the WCW paintings.
You know, I think I have that right here, actually. I think I'm looking at that right now, so I will put it here. It's also, I think it's in the link in the video description, but if anyone is interested in checking it out, absolutely you can. I actually have two of them that I really enjoy looking at. I was looking at them earlier today, and I think I told you about the first one a while ago, but this one right here with Ric Flair and Dusty, obviously being a diehard NWA fan, that one resonates with me very much, as Flair was always in contention with Dusty for the 10 pounds of gold.
And you got a little bit of blood splatter coming off of Flair's face.
Right.
The hardest thing to paint is probably the hardest thing to match color wise is probably Flair's hair color.
Yeah.
Cause it's this white, it's this like super bright blonde, fried blonde hair, and getting the paint to try to match that color is, as a painter, that is, was one of the hardest things to try to match Flair's hair.
Now, the other one, being a sucker for the NWA that I am, there was one point in time where there was a championship, a collection of titles that was represented as the J Cup that was made famous in New Japan Pro Wrestling, but got some run in WCW when Ultimo Dragon would debut for the company under the guidance of Sonny Ono. And for those of you who are familiar with Ultimo Dragon, he had won a tournament where they unified 8 junior heavyweight titles. And in that bunch, not only on WCW television did they have, the the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship. They also had the WWF Light Heavyweight Championship. And as part of that eight was the NWA World Junior Heavyweight Championship. And that's always my favorite little tidbit of history. Like in 96, when the NWA was at its probably least relevant point in time, they had connections with promotions in Japan where they had created this title, and the title was exclusive in Japan. They took the, there was a World Junior Heavyweight Championship in the States, and they retconned it to Japan, and that title ended up, that lineage of the J Crown is connected to the World Junior Heavyweight title that's in the NWA today, that's currently held by Colby Carino. So it's kind of cool to see that that lineage, that title that had so much meaning going back into the to yesteryear, like guys who I grew up watching, like Laser Man, Laser Tag Lou, and Nelson Royal, and even guys like Danny Hodge, Danny Hodge, and having them see that junior heavyweight title, you know, obviously it wasn't the same physical belt, but that lineage, that that history was still there. And to see that on WCW Nitro was just like the coolest thing. And looking back at that, it's still one of my favorite things. And so when you you capture that artwork, I always thought that that was just such an incredible shot, because again, it was representing those eight crowns. And when those eight titles, you know, at one point, those eight titles were United. Thank you. I don't know why I can't speak anymore. United with the WCW Cruiserweight title to make nine belts. And then, you know, WWF, seeing the success of what WCW was doing, introduced its own, you know, light heavyweight division. So they broke up the J Crown, and it was only the two belts, the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title, and of course the WCW Cruiserweight title. And the NWA would finally get their title back too. But it just a weird time in 1996 that the WCW featured an NWA title. And then in 98, WWF would showcase the NWA World Tag Team titles, the NWA North American Championship, and then would even, he didn't defend the title, but Dan Severn would come out with the 10 pounds of gold on Raw. So it was just as an NWA mark, that was always kind of a cool piece of time to look back at. And that's why I like that painting.
Ultimo Dragon was one of those guys I absolutely loved as a kid.
Yeah,
for sure. I mean, he had this martial arts style, but also like he could fly around. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've ever seen anyone like, you know, not tap with the Dragon Sleeper. I think it's still a good finisher. I wish somebody would be using it today. You know, it's, his stuff was always so solid. And when he came out with all those belts, like as a kid, your imagination goes wild. Like, oh, he's competing on the weekends. He's flying over to another country. He's winning other people's belts. You know, how bad is this guy that he's got other companies' titles?
I mean, the way to look at it is it was instant credibility. When he stepped off that set, when he stepped into that ring, and him and Sonny Ono were the first guy I ever saw take a selfie, Sonny Ono, and they had all those title belts, like you knew that this dude was legit. So when mm-hmm. he stepped into the ring with Dean Malenko or Rey Mysterio or Eddie Guerrero, whoever it was, like, you were going to see a good match. And, you know, one of the best matches I've ever seen. I love Lucha Libre, as you know. I love I always often tell people my favorite time in WCW was that cruiserweight division, like in 1997, 1996, that era where you had guys like Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, Rey Mysterio, and Juventud Guerrera, Psicosis, Chris that Jericho. That
cruiserweight division was amazing.
It was so fire. And again, it had such, you know, we look at Rey Mysterio today, and he's probably considered the most absolute famous luchador of all time. But, you know, he doesn't get there if he doesn't spend some time in WCW. And, if, you know, they screwed his career a little bit up. But, you know, the chip got righted towards the end.
Here's the thing about WCW and the booking. Everybody got screwed over. And the problem is, like, when I'm writing this retrospective, and everybody who can say anything negative about what happened has already said it.
Yep.
So I am trying to just be like, wasn't that cool?
Yes, of course. Of course.
Like, you know, yes, it could have been better. Yes. Different, you know, they never should have taken the mask off of Rey. You know, but look at what we did get. And, you know, you just got to be happy with what you, sometimes you just got to be content.
You got to understand, you're preaching to the choir over here. We're mostly NWA fans, and it's never as perfect or beautiful as the way I want it, but I still have this affinity for the brand.
See, oh, like part of the, Alex Wright, when he turned heel.
Oh yeah. Berlin.
The one thing that I will never forgive WCW for is when he turned heel, he should have been renamed to Alex Wrong. That's the one thing, like Berlin, really? No. Like, that's the one thing. But part of the Kickstarter is I did a bunch of these sketch cards. So, you know, I did a whole set of the cruiserweight division. Again, my man, Ultimo Dragon.
Yeah.
La Parca. You know, I had a huge love for Ultimo Dragon.
So Ultimo Dragon, Vader, Mick or Cactus Jack. It seems like you liked guys that had spent some time in Japan before coming to WCW.
Well, you know, that style is a little rougher. And again, I say it in the book, I was a naive child. I believed it.
Yeah.
I absolutely 100% believed it was real. The only time I started to question it was The Undertaker. When he's throwing lightning bolts around the arena, I'm like, there's some pre-production involved in that.
Yeah.
that was the one time as a kid, I was like, something's off. But like, I believed it. I absolutely believed it for a very long time, longer than I should have. But coming from that perspective, I liked the guys that looked realer, that it did resonate as more of a fight or an actual wrestling match.
Let's finish your thought and then let's talk about the Kickstarter.
All right. The other guy who I absolutely loved was DDP.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I was dyslexic. They publicly set out on television. He was dyslexic. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you're dyslexic and you're dealing with all that, you know, stuff, they tell you all these people who were dyslexic and it's like, oh, Albert Einstein or, oh, this Nobel Prize. DDP was somebody who I related to and somebody who inspired me, you know, as a dyslexic kid. It's like, you're telling me the World Heavyweight Champion was dyslexic? Now we're talking.
Give me somebody I can relate to because, you know, Einstein, I'm not Einstein. But I could have been DDP.
Yes.
And the thing about Diamond Dallas Page, and I have this core memory, I was a huge DDP guy when he broke away from being a manager and turned into the wrestler. I remember just enjoying the heck out of his run, and especially that world title run where you know the NWA was actively courting him, and that scene where Scott hands him the shirt and Paul and Scott are celebrating, and then DDP throws the shirt down and gives them both diamond cutters. I mean, his run was pretty wild, and he, you know, I feel too old to be saying this now, but he was an old guy at 36, 37, and he broke into the business, became world champion at 50, and he really did good business for WCW, and I remember being at the, you know, I went to two WCW events before the whole thing shut down. And one of them was in San Diego, California at the Cox Arena. And that night I got to see DDP wrestle. And I got to see Raven and the Flock come down one side, and then I got to see Sting come down to confront the NWO on the other side. I got to see Goldberg before he was on his, you know, win streak, and it was such a cool experience. But that reaction that DDP got was so intense, so intense. And that was before he was even in the world title picture.
And he was again the everyman. He was so loved. And, you know, he'd come through the crowd and, you know, self high five, you know, everybody just loved DDP. And he, you know, even when he was later on in WCW, when he was the bad DDP, I think the fans had a hard time booing him.
Yeah, it was hard. He came out as the triad with him and Canyon and Bam Bam. And they were still fun. I still wanted to watch those guys.
Yeah. Like they tried so hard to make them heels that it didn't work. It just, you know, it's like Rob Van Dam. You can't make him a bad guy. People love him too much.
The lovable stoner, man. Like they can't turn him heel. It just doesn't work. So let's talk about the Kickstarter, because obviously the campaign, you said you've been working on this for roughly, 4 years, the paintings and getting this book into work. But like, when did this go live? When did you decide to start the actual Kickstarter?
The actual campaign went live a couple hours ago.
Nice.
So, I mean, we are live right now. I'm doing my very best not to just keep clicking refresh. This is my 8th Kickstarter campaign. I have a 50-50% success rate with Kickstarters. One of the things that I've always done as a member of all my Kickstarters, even the ones that failed, everybody who backed it got a free PDF of the book.
Wow, that's really cool.
Because you supported me, you showed up, you put money on the table. That means the world to me. And so even though we didn't reach the goal, I still wanted to show my respect and thank you for coming out. This Kickstarter, because the book is, it's a coffee table art book. It's a 200-page coffee table art book. It's the most expensive book I've ever produced. Most of my books come in at $10 to $15. This is an $80 art book. So it is the most expensive thing I've ever produced. The quality is the most, you know, the best quality I could, you know, get. Yeah, hardback. So again, we're asking for 5,000, which again in the world of Kickstarter is not that much. But it's what I need to actually get the book processed and shipped to everyone. You know, because I run pretty thin Kickstarter margins.
And I'm just right now, I'm kind of looking over some of the incentives and everything else. Like you have a lot of rewards for those who donate to the project. I mean, there's many categories. Of course, there's as I'm looking right now, you have the United States Championship, the Cruiserweight Championship. A Cruiserweight Championship with your donation of $10 gets you a digital copy of the book. And and then like the United States Championship gives you a digital copy of the book and then a bookmark set. And then you can add on other options too, like a sketch card or additional bookmark sets or a hand-painted postcard, 11x17 poster. And all the prices are right there. So if you want to, you know, go all in, if you will, there's options for you. Then with each different reward, there's higher incentives. Like if you do the Intercontinental Championship, there's a $40 pledge. You receive 4 items. If you do the Television Championship pledge, you get for $50, you get 5 items. You do the Cruiserweight Championship, you get 8 items, and that one's $100. And then the Hardcore includes 10 items, which is $200. The Women's Championship is $300 and includes 11 items. And there's it keeps going, and everything in there is like you're getting so much for your donation. It's not just, you know, here's a hot dog and a handshake. Good luck, little fella. Like, you're really rewarding your guys who are donating to it.
You know, again, like the bookmarks, I've always done the bookmarks. I'm a big fan of bookmarks. This one I'm very proud of because it's a set of four, and one side's a WCW, the other side's an NWO.
That's really cool.
You know, or like you get on this side is NWO Macho Man and then DDP. Let's try and get the glare. So like the sketch cards, again, an original sketch, as well as, because I thought the trading cards would be fun. On the back of the sketch cards, it's printed to look like an old WCW, you know, trading card from the 90s.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I see it.
So one side's your classic trading card, and the other side's an original sketch. Also, if you do something like one of the older, like the sketch cards or something that can fit in an envelope, like, you're going to get an envelope. This is something I stole from Wizard Magazine back in the day.
Nice.
Envelope that one side has an original sketch on it.
That's really cool.
So, like, that's for some of the you know, tiers that aren't so, you know, so packed with the book and stuff. Because, again, unfortunately, the book itself retails for $80. So a lot of the smaller tiers, I'm trying to give you as much as I can, you know, for A, the support, and B, you know, I want you to walk away with something. I want you to, you know, if you know, I like, you know, we did hand-painted postcards. So I was trying to, here's a blank sketch card. So it's just got the, you know, but, we did a bunch of, like, here's a painting of Scott Norton. That's a postcard, you know, Kimberly Page, Buff Bagwell, you know, Raven versus DDP. So those are actually postcards that, you know, you can get mailed out to you, and you get an original painting, you know, because that's watercolor and ink.
And then when does the project how long do they have to
April 30th is the last day. So it's basically the whole month of April.
Right.
You know? And then,
so, and I don't mean to sound like negative, but like, if you don't reach your goal of 5,000, what do you do? Do you just stop, or do you try to go again, or how does that work?
If I don't reach the goal, I have another route that will pursue, but the quality of the book's not going to be necessarily what I believe this project deserves.
Well, we're going to make sure to put this video, this link, all the information, we'll put that on the alliance-wrestling.com website. Plus, this video will be on our YouTube page as well as on our podcasting station, so that other people can, if they hear it, they'll have the opportunity to find those links to get invested, to get in on this project. Because again, it's not just about you know, Brandon making a book, it's also about showcasing the love and admiration for WCW and kind of reclaiming those three initials that have seemingly gone by the wayside in recent years, and kind of bring back those good feelings that WCW brought to many of us throughout the 80s and 90s.
And here's the thing, like I said, there's 150 paintings, right? Well, this one's a CM Punk. But like, you donate to the Kickstarter at a certain rate, you're gonna get an original painting.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, like, I have a lot of these paintings, and I know you've bought a few from me over the years. And it's most people are going to walk away with some original art, right? Like, that's the thing. Like, here's my, oh yeah, I love that piece I did for you, the AWA belt.
NWA.
The NWA belt, yeah.
I was looking for this because this was hanging up earlier, but it must have fallen down. But I have the Harley Race and Ric Flair in the steel cage.
Mm-hmm.
That one was one of my favorites. I had that. That was sitting up here, but I guess it fell down earlier. That Flair for the gold, baby, right there.
Yeah. You know, finger poke of doom.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff.
The Nash power bomb.
Oh, that was such a scary power bomb because no one had taken Big Show off his feet like that.
Unfortunately, at that point, everybody, it was a test of like, oh, if Goldberg can get Big Show up, yeah, I can get Big Show up. And no, you can't. You know, people were doing stuff with Big Show that they really shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, let's change gears just a little bit because
one last NWO.
Oh yeah. And you know, I know a lot of you guys out there go to the autograph signings, you go to Frank and Sons when they have talent there, or you know, here locally, the wrestling shop, not locally, but in Southern California. And you know, these are perfect things to get signed by some of the legends that these are things that they would never see. That's awesome. That's Knobs and
Norman Smiley.
Yes, Big Willie. The big
back at the end of the WCW hardcore division.
Do you have any Ming ones?
I'm not finished. I have two Mings that are the him getting hit with the pepper spray by Miss Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And then I have one of him choking out the cat that is in the middle of production.
Nice.
Because again, like I said off there, there's a few more paintings that I want to get done, mostly because I feel like WCW was around for a long time, and there are some people that are just not going to be in the book.
Yeah.
But there are some people that I feel like I need to at least acknowledge their contributions in some of the events. Like, I still have to paint Medusa throwing away the women's championship.
Oh. Yeah.
You know, there's some big events that I still need to hit just to cover what I feel of the history of the company.
Yeah. Well, that's that. I mean, I'm excited for you. I think this is a great idea. I'm definitely going to be purchasing one of the books when it comes out, and I will be getting on that contribution board probably next payday. But I'm excited for you. I think this is, you could tell that you have passion behind this. This isn't something you're just doing just to make a buck. This is something you believe in and that you care about. And I think that's really cool. There's not enough wrestling fans like that these days. I feel like a lot of times people are just in it to make money, which is, I mean, it takes everybody, right? But I think it's cool that what you're doing, and I kind of pull myself into the same equation, like guys like you, guys like me, we're talking about the history of this business because it's something that we grew up with. It's something that we care about. It's something that still means something to us. And, you know, if it's not for people like you and people like me to keep promoting not just what's happening today, but what happened in the past. I mean, the old adage is if you forget the past, you're doomed to repeat it. But, you know, if nobody talks about it, then it never happened. So I applaud your efforts into trying to keep that history alive. And again, the more obscure stuff, the better, because, you know, not everything is going to be on that WWE Network/Peacock deal. You're not going to be able to see everything forever. And it's going to be,
there are some things on there that I'd love to watch that aren't even on that.
Yeah.
The old, the WCW Saturday Night Live, does, they don't have all the seasons. They don't have, you know, back when it was the studio set.
Yeah.
You know, and there was good matches. The sad part about WCW is they always had a stacked roster. They always had, in my opinion, the better in-ring wrestling.
Yes, for sure. I don't think that's even up for debate. I feel like, again, when you look at what WCW had, you know, going even from the early 90s, like, you know, they had guys like Barry Windham and Dustin Rhodes and Sting and
the Natural Dustin Rhodes.
Yeah, and Lex Luger. And, you know, these guys, I mean, a lot of them came from the NWA, sure. But then, like, the guys that they continued to bring in, the Too Cold Scorpio. Too Cold Scorpio was doing shit nobody was doing.
Stuff that people aren't doing today.
Yes, exactly.
And he was a 450 leg drop.
Amazing.
You know, he defied gravity. I don't know. He turned it off. I don't know how he did the things that he did.
And he wasn't a small, he wasn't a junior heavyweight by any stretch. He was a big guy.
Yeah.
You know, he was, you know, 220, you know, he wasn't a little, he wasn't like a, you know, with no disrespect intended to some of the cruiserweights we see or junior heavyweights we see nowadays, but, you know, he was over 200 pounds, over 220 doing moves like that. Not, you know, 165 pounds soaking wet, being able to do flips and dips and everything else. He was a guy who was built like a man doing uncanny things.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about Destiny Comics, because obviously, you know, wrestling is part of your love and passion, but it's not the only thing that you do. Let's talk a little bit about Destiny Comics before I let you go.
And okay. Of
course, if people want to check out what you're doing with Destiny Comics, it's just the www.destinycomics. It's
very easy. I'm going to send you a link to my store.
I think I'm on it right now. The Weebly?
Weebly, yeah.
Yeah, I'll put the link right here also in the chat, and it'll put it up here on the screen. Destiny Comics with an X.weebly.com. Yes. And you have a variety of characters and Flatfoot McGee, 8-bit pulp, excuse me. Terrifying Gruesome Tales of Horror, Mr. Cuddles, Novels and Funnies. Where do these inspirations come from? Flatfoot McGee, you've told me a little bit about in the past, how he's kind of a detective, like a noir type detective. Tell me about
this. Flatfoot McGee is born out of my love for classic animation.
Okay.
The graphic novel is 108 pages, hand-painted. Everything's watercolor and ink. Took me about 3 years to do the first graphic novel. He is a duck detective in a Looney Tunes-inspired universe.
Okay.
So, like, the first issue, the first big story, first big case in the graphic novel is... I did an homage to the death of George Reeves, where, you know, basically this Mighty Mouse-esque figure is murdered, and people have hired him to figure out whether or not it was suicide or whether it was a murder.
Okay.
And, you know, it deals with a lot of that old... You know, because in this world, yes, cartoons are real, but they're also like, they're the studio. The cartoons are actors in these things. And so I get to, you know, there's Flatfoot McGee is, again, a love letter to like the 1930s. It's Dick Tracy. It's, you know, dames and dolls and cartoons and cartoon physics, and with a little bit of that noir edge to it, because there are a few characters who unfortunately don't see it all the way to the end of the book.
So you have a little bit of realism in there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I started working on, like, because the first Flatfoot short came out in 09. I did a book called Tales of Destiny Comics, which basically had the first short, Mr. Cuddles, first short, Mr. Flatfoot McGee, and a few other things. Again, Flatfoot McGee is, you know, I'm wearing the shirt right now. Probably the thing I'm the most proudest of, because it's also the most, it's the book that I want to just keep drawing for the rest of my life.
So are you still currently working on that book as well?
Yes. I'm working on, I don't know when it's going to come out, because I have my publishing schedule for this year planned out. Mm-hmm. So the next Flatfoot will probably be next year. Again, with indie comics, I could do the issue by issue by issue, but I think for me personally, just having the graphic novel on my table works best. So I'll wait till I have another 100 pages of Flatfoot before I publish again. Terrifyingly Gruesome Tales of Horror is my yearly Halloween horror anthology. So it's a black and white book that comes out every October. It's just a series of short stories. They don't continue on to the next one. The reason why it's called that is there's something in the 1940s, maybe, yeah, 1940s, 45. Probably later, 48. Called the Comics Code Authority. Congress got involved with the comics. They laid down these rules that every comic book had to abide by.
Yes.
And part of the rules were you could never publish a book that had horror, terror, gruesome in the cover. So Terrifyingly Gruesome Tales of Horror is, you know, that's my old man joke. That is, these are all the words that were banned at one point, and I'm doing a book that has all the banned words in it. So each, you know, we do one every year. Typically we do a photo shoot with a model for the cover. So the covers are photo, and, you know, like one issue has a sexy witch. The next issue, we did a sexy ghost. And then we did like a sexy zombie.
There's a theme
to the covers. We used to do more photo shoots with the 8-bit pulp stuff.
Yeah.
But basically now we just do the one pinup photo shoot for the cover, and I only do one shoot a year. And it's, you know, the sexy horror theme.
That's interesting, man.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun comic stuff. And then Mr. Cuddles was the first book I really did. Mr. Cuddles, I have a couple Cuddles books out. But he's an angelically possessed teddy bear protecting his family against zombies, vampires, and babysitters.
Babysitters, nice.
So it is a younger reader book. I made a mistake early on where I did a story with a vampire and there was blood.
Oh no.
And that was a little too much for one of the younger readers. So Mr. Cuddles is probably the most family friendly safe thing in the catalog that I've done, you know, and again, it's everything I do is kind of like tongue in cheek. There's usually puns and jokes, and, you know, one of the things I did with Flatfoot is he was fighting a baker, in a bakery setting. And over the course of four pages, I threw in as much bread baking puns as I could. It got to the point to where I'm Googling puns and just trying to find as many ways to cram in dad jokes into this fight scene.
And all the nooks and crannies, if you will.
Yes.
So let me ask you this then. I guess I didn't know you, not only are you drawing and painting, but you're also writing all the material as well.
Yes.
That's awesome.
There's a couple of the shorts I've had friends with come in and write some stuff. My first graphic novel was I had a friend write it because I didn't know if I could really trust myself yet.
Yeah.
And he did a great job. And, you know, but it was a learning experience. Like, okay, I can do this and I can figure this out. And being dyslexic, I do have spelling issues. So my wife is my long suffering editor.
Yeah. You know, I know how that is. What one time my wife, you've met Michelle, she literally transcribed an entire interview for me. And I was like, okay, cool. She said she'd do it. I'm going to let you do it. But that was a very, as many times as I tried to thank her, it was a thankless job.
Yeah. My wife went over and edited all the stuff for the Kickstarter. And I'm like, I wrote this 3 months ago. So if you have a word that doesn't make sense, I don't know what to tell you.
Nice. You'll just have to wing it and we'll figure it out.
Yeah, she's in the book. She's also credited as my editor. That's cool. Because again, there was I wrote like three paragraphs per painting, and a lot of that makes it into the book, and she's got to go in and fix my ramblings, me rambling poetically about Bam Bam Bigelow.
I hope you have a lot of alliterations for Bam Bam Bigelow.
I did the best I could.
Well, you know, with such a master, I didn't mean master, just a huge undertaking this is, I'm really excited to see what it's going to turn out to be. I have been following you for a while. I do see some of those posts that you have been putting up. So I'm excited to see all of this come into light. And of course, we'll be talking about it here on the podcast, as well as we'll put links onto the website for folks to check it out. But before we let you go and call it a night, is there anything else you want to plug? I do have your link tree in the chat. Plus I put it up here on the screen so that folks can easily find all of your socials and all that good stuff at linktree.com/destinycomics. But is there anything else you want to plug before we say goodnight?
The main thing right now, because if you're following me on any of my social medias, right now the only thing that's getting plugged is the Kickstarter. So it's getting posted 3-4 times a day. I apologize to the people who see every post, but the way the algorithm works is not everyone sees every post.
Right.
And that's a shame, because you click follow and then you don't actually get to see some of the stuff I post. I'm not a fan of some of that algorithm nonsense.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer. And as being like a content creator as well, I see it too, where you'll post something and people will be like, I missed that. Really? It's been on my Instagram for months now. You missed it? But yeah, they miss it. It's real easy to miss.
Yeah. So every day until the Kickstarter ends, I've done 30 little videos of like me filming me painting like Ric Flair, or filming me painting Harlem Heat, or so every day, you know, it's a different video and it's a different subject, but there's 30 days of me painting DDP or Arachnaman, or, you know. So please follow, like, subscribe, all that fun stuff on my Instagram, and also the Kickstarter. The main thing is the Kickstarter.
And you have a YouTube page as well that I suggest for some great voice impression work that folks should check out your YouTube page. I was particularly fond of the Dusty promo.
Let me tell you something, brother. My chest was pounding. It was late night. I didn't know what to do, brother. I had to get up and I had to grab the paintbrush because the paint was flowing, brother.
That's awesome, man. So again, linktree.com, Destiny Comics, of course, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you know, get out there, YouTube, get out there, like, comment, subscribe. Please, if you could, make a donation of any amount to the Kickstarter, of course. You know, if you want to get some cool items, you're going to want to pay a little bit more than just the standard pledge, but $10 will get you a digital copy of the book. And, you know, that in and of itself is worth it because the book itself is going to be very cool. And I'm
over 200 pages.
Over 200 pages. That's less than $1 a page.
Mm-hmm. Also, if you can't give to the Kickstarter, I understand times are, share the link.
Yeah.
Just, you know, help spread the word. We're, you know, 4 years worth of work. And I'd love to see this not just fade to the background of Kickstarter.
Very much so. Well, Brandon, thank you so much for your time. I wish you nothing but the best of luck on this. And that's going to do it for us, guys. Again, I'll be back here tomorrow with the pre-party. And then on Wednesday, it'll be the other Alliance guys. And then on Thursday, we'll be talking more NWA on the Alliance Guys podcast. But until next time, we'll see you guys at the matches.
Thanks for joining the stream. This has been a presentation of alliance-wrestling.com. We genuinely appreciate your support. Would you consider subscribing so you'll never miss a future episode? I'd also like to remind you, we do a live stream every Tuesday at 5 p.m. for NWA Power. You can find us on social media at the Alliance Blog. And until next time, we